We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 2, Good Trouble. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. What's school without getting into a little trouble? Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Beth Sutton Ramspeck about rule breaking and creativity in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College, and author of a number of Harry Potter essays.
Today's topic, Emily, is good trouble, borrowing from John Lewis's famous phrase about rule-breaking for the right reasons.
And so, love that phrase.
It's a good way to think about it, right? So I'm going to put you on the spot, Emily. Did you ever get into any hijinks at school?
I should really plead the fifth here, but the answer is yes.
Uh-huh.
And it was often where I sort of determined that the rule was silly and stupid and shouldn't apply to one such as myself. So I actually skipped school to buy concert tickets. This was back in the day. Remember when you had to like wait in line to buy concert tickets?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I ended up getting in some trouble for doing that.
That's not exactly what we mean by good trouble, although
no.
I see where your priorities were there.
It was a good concert though.
And that really, you know, and the kids in the Harry Potter series, definitely they're not above a little bit of just regular kid style trouble. But we want to talk today about a different kind of trouble, you know, getting into trouble for good reasons. And I have to admit, in my own school career, I was kind of like early days Hermione, you know, we could die or worse, be expelled. Like that was totally me. Very rule abiding student.
I'm not going to lie. I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that.
I
can also
like
sense your growth from that, those beginnings.
Yes. I would categorize myself as like lawful good. If you've seen those divisions, you know, the lawful good. I like if there's a problem with a law, I want to change the law, but to do it in a way that, you know, is institutional and structurally based.
it takes patience.
Yes. Right. It's not really good for everything. We need a little chaotic good every now and again.
I have that covered. So,
Okay. Good. Good. Well, our special guest for this episode is Dr. Beth Sutton Ramspeck, newly retired professor of literature at Ohio State University, Lima. She's working on a book manuscript about misbehavior and rule breaking in the Harry Potter series. Welcome to Potterversity, Beth.
Hi, Emily. Hi, Katie. Nice to be here.
Beth, great to have you.
Yeah, this is so wonderful. And when we saw your talk at the Harry Potter Academic Conference, we knew that we wanted to have you on the show to talk a little bit about what you're working on. I'm really interested, Beth, that you are a scholar of Victorian literature in particular. How did you get interested in the idea of rule breaking in the Harry Potter series?
Well, of course, I started reading Harry Potter as completely an escape from what I usually do. It's one of those things you can read because you don't have to write anything about it, which of course changed
right.
a lot. I started reading it with my daughter when she was 8. The first book came out when my daughter was an 8-year-old and got completely engrossed in it. And in part because it was complicated. And I think I implicitly knew how much Rowling is indebted to Victorian novelists. And it's, you know, simple things like, you know, character names coming from George Eliot and Jane Austen and things like that. But I always liked the rule breakers in Victorian literature. I liked Jane Eyre and Maggie Tulliver and characters like that. But I really got started on this when I wanted to go to a conference in England about creativity, and I needed to come up with something to write about. And so I thought, okay, well, creativity, I'm teaching these classes in the Harry Potter books. Where can I talk about creativity in that? And I started actually doing a search for the word creative and realized that it was used most often with Voldemort because he creates Horcruxes. And I started doing some research about creativity. There's a whole field of study called creativity studies. And one of the definitions of creativity is that it's rule breaking. And because something is creative when it has two features. It's new or unique on the one hand, and on the second hand, it's useful or has value. That works with the aesthetic kind of stuff. But the point is that it's not doing things the way they've always been done. So, for example, when people started writing poetry without rhyme, or when Copernicus said that the earth goes around the sun after centuries where the scientific rule was that the sun went around the earth. You know, or for that matter, you know, putting a camera into a telephone. These are all ways or for creative ways of breaking rules. You know, that's kind of the whole deal. So originally, I was arguing that the most creative people in this series were the greatest rule breakers, which were especially Voldemort, but also people like Dolores Umbridge, who is she's very creative, right? She comes up with, you know, that horrible pen, for example. And Voldemort was breaking the rule that everyone dies. And that the soul should remain whole. And as I said, the word create is used most often with him. But after I wrote that paper, and as I started thinking more about rule breaking in the whole series and realizing, well, you know, Harry breaks a lot of rules, and how does this work in with this other argument I made? I started looking more closely, and I realized that really Voldemort and the other characters, although they break rules, they're bound by some of the most dangerous rules in wizard culture, that purebloods are better than muggleborns and wizards are better than house elves or goblins or centaurs or what have you. And so that they're not in some ways as rule breaking as I thought they were.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that because I had read your piece about the, you know, the Death Eaters and Voldemort and Dolores Umbridge being really creative in their, I would say, bad trouble, right? But but the idea that they actually are bound by certain like social rules and structures and these kind of pure-blooded ideas that they are in service of.
Yeah, and that's the real flaw, is that they're thinking, I guess, small, that their creativity is not about the most important things, ultimately.
Reading your work, I was really struck by, I've always been struck by a lot of your ideas, I was really struck by this focus on rules in a whole new way. Because, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, with the big Potter panic that happened then, a lot of people's, if people didn't have Christian objections to the books, then they had objections about the way the characters would break rules so often and not really be punished or not have the kind of consequences you might expect for breaking those rules. And so I find your work on this really interesting and really, you know, somewhat ironic. Why do you think that rule breaking makes adults so uneasy? And what are we missing about rule breaking in Harry Potter if we're only looking at it from that authority figure or rule maker point of view?
Well, my own daughter is grown, but I well remember what it was like having a rebellious kid who broke a lot of rules. I think they all do. And it's hard as a parent. You know, you set up these rules you think are going to make your kid more safe. Some of them are just simply for your own convenience, you know, shut up, kid. And if you've got a school, I mean, one of the book banning cases that actually there was a legal case about with Harry Potter had to do with, it wasn't a Christian school, it was a public school, but it was about rule breaking in the series. They wouldn't let kids have the books because they, you know, were about breaking rules. And obviously schools need to keep things in order, and Hogwarts is a school too, right? So it's, some of it is pure safety. Some of it is just convenience for parents and for teachers that you don't want a whole lot of chaos. I get that. What I think people are missing is that sometimes chaos is good. You know, Dumbledore obviously realizes that kids learn a lot from trying things out, and sometimes there are consequences to trying things out that are a little bit dangerous, you know, which is really hard for a parent to handle. But you know, the most important thing is that some rules are more important than others. And if you're operating on a larger principle, then, you know, that's okay. I mean, you know, you sometimes in real life, you often have to balance different responsibilities, different obligations, different needs against one another. You know, when Harry and Ron steal the Fort Anglia, they get Mr. Weasley in trouble. They didn't really have to steal it. They just thought more carefully. And, you know, they feel legitimately bad in the end. You know, all kinds of bad things happen as a result. That's not a legitimate reason to break the rules. But when they're deciding, hey, you know, we need to save the Sorcerer's Stone from Voldemort, they're breaking the rule that they're not supposed to go into that corridor and they're not supposed to bother Fluffy and the whole business. But the point is, hey, you know, what could happen if Voldemort gets a hold of this stone and can live forever? This is dangerous. He could do all kinds of awful things. So sure, they're breaking a rule and they could get expelled. And Harry basically says there's more important stuff than that. I'll live with it because this other principle is larger. And that is what I think parents can talk to their kids about it. You know, it's if you just set the kid loose, maybe they'll learn bad principles. But honestly, I don't think so, because usually when these kids are breaking the rules, not always, but usually a rule that they shouldn't break, there's a consequence. And if it's, there are more important principles, they get away with it. It's not always true. And that's part of what makes the series interesting, too, is that it's complex. It's not as simple as, you know, bad things happen, bad consequences happen. Do something good, everything's awesome. But a lot of the time, that's the way it works out.
Yeah, I really like how this reminds me of what you were saying with your first answer, that, you know, the Death Eaters are sort of thinking too small, that there are these larger moral principles and rules that people need to be sensitive to. And sometimes you've got two different rule systems that are in opposition to each other. And it's actually a good thing to teach children how to think about what is actually the most important of these rules to be following in this moment. Beth, your talk at Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Academic Conference this year was called Creative Maladjustment: Creativity and Resistance in Harry Potter. How do you think does Harry Potter reflect this idea that Martin Luther King Jr. talked about of creative maladjustment, again, to those, you know, those rules that actually maybe are not in accordance with the sort of higher set of moral order?
I found King's article really interesting because I had not heard about it until just a few months ago. I found it. It was a speech that he gave to the American Psychological Association in 1967, and it was published as an article in the spring of 1968, right after his assassination. And it's not one of his better known pieces at all. He was talking to psychologists, and he was playing off the idea of being maladjusted, which is not a good thing, right? Not adjusting, being out of place, not knowing how to act, and so on. But he turns it on its head because he says, well, okay, psychologists are wanting to make sure that you're not maladjusted, but maybe they should be thinking about creative maladjustment, because there, he says, there are some things to which we must always be maladjusted if we are people of goodwill. And the kinds of things that he talks about are, not surprisingly, racial inequality, economic inequality, war. And his idea, he's not real specific about what he means by creative maladjustment, but it's adjustment that is, it's maladjustment that is designed to fix things that are bad. And of course, he does mention civil disobedience, nonviolence, you know, all of the things that he's best known for, which are in fact really creative and in fact useful forms of resistance. One of the things that I've learned is that scholars who have studied nonviolent resistance have found that movements that are based on nonviolence are more effective at getting things done. And creativity, one of the definitions of creativity is that it's novel, it's unexpected on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's useful. And since it turns out that nonviolence is useful and it's not the way things are generally done, it fits in, you know, really rather effectively with the idea of creative maladjustment. And of course, what Harry is doing ultimately is also, he is opposing discrimination against Muggles and against Muggle-borns, though he's also just directly fighting Voldemort. And I think that one of the things you could say is that some of his larger principles he gets from Hermione, who has a broader sense of things, I think, than any of the other young people. But he's, you know, it has a lot to do what he's doing. It has a lot in common with anti-racist activism. And of course, his signature move is Expelliarmus, which is nonviolent. And that's how he manages to succeed, not with the aggressive spells, but with a nonviolent spell.
Do you think it helps that Harry is an outsider some to the wizarding world and its particular racist structures and, you know, kind of cultural expectations?
Absolutely. Hermione, too, really.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, both of them. Both of them, very much so. No, and that's actually one of the things that creativity scholars talk about, is that creative people tend to have what they call diversifying experiences, which basically means they've had a chance to be outside of the mainstream of their particular culture, which in some cases is just a lot of reading or maybe a lot of international travel. In the case of Hermione and Harry, they're diversified from magical culture because they didn't grow up in it. So they are outsiders. And so they have a perspective on things that people inside don't have. And I think, well, they have that in common with the Weasley family in general, because Arthur Weasley is fascinated with Muggles, and, you know, they're seen as race traitors and all of this business. But they too have an outsider's perspective up to a point. And that outsider's perspective goes a long way towards creative thinking. So yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you on that.
And yet, this maladjustment is so often interpreted, even sometimes in Harry Potter, as insanity, right? Why do you think this is, both in the wizarding world and in our own society? Why are people who are maladjusted, you know, even in the right ways, you know, sometimes assumed to be unstable or insane?
Nutters,
well,
right?
Nutters.
Yeah, exactly.
Weirdos.
That's the word. All right. Weirdos. Yeah, no. Well, some of this, yeah, there is a truism that has a certain amount of truth about creativity and creative people. You think about somebody like, you know, Vincent van Gogh or William Blake. I mean, there are plenty of examples of creative people, especially in the aesthetic world, but also, you know, I mean, Abraham Lincoln suffered from depression. Steve Jobs was a little odd. You know, creative people are often not really normal in the sense that we sometimes think of it. But it's also true that people who are creative often are, they're not following the social rules in various ways. So, for example, in the Victorian period, you know, one of the stories most people now study in college is the yellow wallpaper, which is based on a true story from Charlotte Perkins Gilman's life. The Victorian women who wanted to have a career, who wanted to be creative, who wanted to write, were considered a little crazy, and they were prescribed a rest cure to stop doing all of that thinking that was going to make them crazy. Well, of course, in the case of the yellow wallpaper, and actually in Gilman's own life, that just made it worse. But that treatment of somebody who is different, well, you can't be quite sane. That is, we see that a lot. You see that, I mean, in the Soviet Union today, in Russia, people who are dissidents are often put in psychiatric hospitals. And the same thing has happened in China. It's a way of dealing with troublemakers that is, it's a stigma, and it's a way of locking them up without saying, well, this is actually prison. It's, oh, well, we're taking care of you because you aren't thinking about things right. So there's some of it is true. There does seem to be a higher amount of mental illness among some creative people. And some of it is a matter of social stigma, social control, things like that. In the Harry Potter world, I mean, you know, Harry is accused of being delusional when he says that Voldemort's back. Dumbledore is saying, they're saying he's losing his grip. It's, you know, it's a way of making people look bad. So it's kind of a mixed bag. There can be some truth in it, and there can be a lot of social manipulation, a way of exerting power to call people crazy when they're different.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, I was thinking about Virginia Woolf, who talks about, you know, Shakespeare's sister and what her life would have been like. And she imagines Shakespeare, you know, this is why you don't see genius in women, because women who are being fully, you know, creative and ingenious, they're going to go insane, essentially, trying to deal with the various, we would say, maybe glass ceilings or restrictions that they're subjected to. But I was also thinking along those lines, thinking of my elf and Mystique, about how Dobby and Creature are both talked about in ways that suggest they're crazy. And they are both maladjusted to the role of the house elf in some ways. Different ways,
absolutely. Absolutely. It's impossible for wizards, or for that matter, compliant house elves, to see them as normal because, well, they aren't normal. They're not following the norms. And the assumption, I mean, you know, Hagrid says you get weirdos in every type. You know, there's this assumption that is the way things are naturally, but the very fact that Creature and Dobby, and in her own odd way Winky, are rebelling against those norms shows that maybe it's not so natural after all, that there is something amiss there, and it helps you to see that maybe what a lot of people think of is, oh, well, this is somehow normalizing slavery. I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think there's a great deal of questioning.
Yeah. And sort of, as you said, it's pointing out that there are problems with it, such that the, you know, the house elves who are in the normal range, they're worried about it, like being contagious, or, you know, that they might catch some of these things. And so that shows that maybe it's not, if it's natural, you don't have to worry about it, you know, you don't have to worry about stamping down on it. So let's talk about what is creative here in Harry and the Dumbledore's army and their reactions to the problems that they are witnessing in the wizarding world. What are some of the creative responses that they have?
Well, some of the creativity is, you know, just creative problem solving. There's, you know, a whole lot of mysteries that are being solved and figuring things out, which involves some creative thinking, and the risky decisions that Harry makes at various points. Risk taking is a creative thing. Hermione is really creative. Fundamentally, she is, you know, defying this whole idea of what's right. You know, she champions the rights of house elves, to a lesser extent, but somewhat goblins. But she's the one who proposes Dumbledore's army. She's the one who invents the fake coins that they communicate with. She's the one who designs the enchanted parchment that jinxes anyone who reveals their secret. She is just you know, full of creative ideas. It's, you know, I used to think of Hermione as, you know, the good girl who was just smart. But it's not just that, because she really is coming up with new ideas. And you've got Luna, who I didn't originally think of as necessarily that much a part of the resistance, other than she's sort of along for the ride. Obviously, and the first thing we're introduced to her as Loony Lovegood, so she's totally just doesn't know how to interact with people the way she's supposed to. But she represents, I think, in some ways more strongly than almost any of the other characters, the way that Dumbledore says that is the most powerful opponent to Voldemort and to the Death Eaters, which is love. You know, she's all about friendship. Her name, obviously, Lovegood, but you know, the picture on the wall of her bedroom with the chains between people, and she's all about doing things her own way, her own very creative way, and always out of compassion and faith and kindness. And so her oddness is part of what makes her not, you know, the authoritarian, autonomous, all those awful things that Voldemort stands for. And of course, Harry himself, his use of nonviolence, his use of defensive spells that defeat the Crowling Curse, and the idea that he defeats Voldemort in the most sort of surprising way. Obviously, it's a surprise. It works. It's creative in the sense that it's surprising and it's useful. He manages to kill Voldemort without actually killing him by losing, by dying. I mean, obviously, we got to give J.K. Rowling a lot of credit for the creative idea of this. Yeah, that's the other creative force in this whole business that we cannot overlook. Right. But it is Harry who, you know, at each stage sort of, you know, takes the risk and manages to overcome in the most creative and surprising ways you can imagine.
That's true about Rowling. A lot of times when people talk about her as an author, they talk about all the rules she broke with Harry Potter, you know, in terms of the length of the book, in terms of, you know, what she's writing about, and basically breaking all the rules of publishing at the time. And now, of course, those rules are totally rewritten. But since we're sort of on the topic of Voldemort, I wanted to get your ideas about him as creatively maladjusted. Does this description apply to Voldemort himself?
I think partly. I mean, he's definitely maladjusted, right? Clearly, he's a psychological mess.
Everybody write that down. Write that down. It's very important. You know that.
But he's not. And he is creative in the sense that he is, okay, there's one of the definitions. There are a lot of people, creativity scholars, I think, do an awful lot of coming up with ideas that are pretty much impossible to prove very creatively. But one of the theories is that creativity involves three kinds of defiance, and one of them is defying the crowd, meaning how people in, you know, neuroscience or classical composition or what have you do things. Yeah, you know, so that kind of defiance. And one of them is defying yourself, which is basically learning the way you were doing things before was not working so well. So learning from yourself, defying yourself. And the third one is defying the zeitgeist, which is, it can be a whole field, but can it also be a cultural thing? And I think the thing about Voldemort is that he is not doing magic the way everybody else does magic. He's creative in his magic, but he's no good at learning things and questioning himself and asking, am I doing things the right way? And he certainly has bought into the whole wizard, conservative wizard culture about natural superiority of pure bloods and the superiority of wizards over muggles and the superiority of wizards over any other magical being. And so in that sense, he's not really all that creative. And he's only maladjusted in the psychological sense, not in the sense that Martin Luther King talked about. In creativity studies, there's been a lot more talk in recent years about what they call malevolent creativity. And that would be people like hackers, right? Yeah. To be a good hacker, you have to be creative, but your intentions are bad.
Destructive, right? Even. Destructive instead
destructive,
of constructive.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So creativity, we usually think of that. Oh, creativity is so good. But there are forms of creativity that are malevolent. And obviously, that would fit in with what Voldemort's doing, what Umbridge is doing, what Rita Skeeter is doing, right? She's very creative. She's quite the fiction writer. And she has this quick quills pen and everything, but her intentions are not good. She just wants to get some notoriety for herself and make some money and, you know, do something exciting. She's not interested in the truth. So there's a difference. Creativity is not necessarily a good thing. And so it's certainly legitimate to say that Voldemort is creative without putting him in the same category of or that he's maladjusted, without saying he is, that you can't credit him with creative maladjustment. Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to go back to Luna, because I'm really fascinated by what you said about Luna on this. And I've been thinking about it as our conversation has continued. I was thinking about how, you know, we first see her reading something upside down. And, you know, I think in the movie, she's got the, I can't remember what it's called. I call them Spectre Specs in my mind, but there's some kind of different glasses that she's wearing. And that she maybe also has a little bit of that outsider quality. She's always looking for, you know, the conspiracy or looking for the thing that people aren't talking about. So what you were saying in terms of defiance of the zeitgeist, I wondered if Luna maybe fits that mode particularly well among the kids.
Yeah, she does. I think she is less principled about it than, say, Hermione, or even to a certain extent, Harry. And Ron is traveling in that direction. But she is, definitely, she has a unique perspective, and it's gentler than what you see around her. And you know, there is, in spite of the fact that half the creatures that she's enthusiastic about don't actually exist, you know, she is at least sensitive to them. And she is, you know, the fact that she ends up with Newt's commander's grandson or whatever it is, according to Rowling's description of what happens after the book, it makes perfect sense that she would be out there defending creatures that are not usually respected.
And even kind of pushing the notion that what we perceive and what we assume about the world isn't all there is. You know,
absolutely.
That there are more things out there than we've kind of put our noggins to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think we've got to talk about the Weasley twins a little bit on the creativity. Mm. And I think that, you know, somebody like Dolores Umbridge or Filch would say malevolent creativity. You know, that they do a lot of things that actually do seem like they're destructive. They create obstacles. You know, they're helping you to get out of class, right? Skiving snack boxes. Mm. What do you think? How do they fit in? Is that a kind of good trouble, or is that just regular trouble?
They're an interesting example, because I think they start out as just troublemakers, basically. I mean, if you look at something like the Tun Toffee, they're basically just bullying Dudley,
that's
honestly.
Mean. It's mean.
Okay, so Dudley is horrible person, but he doesn't deserve that. And It's funny from one perspective, but if you stand back a little further, you go, ooh, maybe not so much. If you put yourself in Dudley's shoes, that was kind of awful. And so their creativity and their inventiveness early on is basically just mischief. But as the series progresses, you know, they start not just trying to get out of class, but they really are aiming that stuff at Dolores Umbridge. And there's a place in there where they say, have you noticed that we have not been doing anything because we want to make sure that people can study? And, you know, they only, they're aiming their mischief as a form of resistance. They are doing a creative kind of demonstration because Dolores Umbridge is a really awful authoritarian figure who is worthy of rebellion. Then by the time you get to the end, yes, yeah, sure, they're making money off of their shop, but they have a specialty in items that can be used to fight the dark arts. And so they have morphed from pure mischief to people who are using their creativity, because they have a lot of it, and they're definitely rule breakers, to people who are using that for a larger purpose, not just to have fun or to make money, but to oppose the forces of evil associated with the Death Eaters and with the ministry.
And they seem aware also, even I know, you know, you're right, they have the line of products that you can kind of fight the dark arts with, but they also seem to be aware that people need to laugh in this stressful, terrible time that the wizarding world is in. And mm-hmm. they seem aware of the fact that their products help people to be able to sort of laugh in the face of their troubles.
Yeah.
You know, even if it just makes them feel better.
So one of the talks at the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill that really struck me, and that dovetails nicely about humor, where she talks about that one of the ways that humor works is by breaking the rules. And that's clearly a lot of what happens with the Weasley twins, is that they are making people laugh through their violation of expectations. And in some cases, part of what they're doing is also making fun of bringing down the dignity of Voldemort. They have, you know, the You Know Poo product or something. I forget the exact details.
Yeah,
of it, but
You Know Poo, right?
It's a matter of, and it's kind of like the ridiculous mm-hmm. curse or charm.
Yeah.
It's a way of sort of disrupting fear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know,
Gene Sharp, making fun. Yeah.
Yeah. You were making me think about Gene Sharp wrote a book called From Dictatorship to Democracy, where he detailed lots of different forms of nonviolent resistance, and humor and pranks was one of them. And it undermines power in a very interesting way, right? The court jester can speak truth. And there are ways that pranks and laughter are a kind of defiance.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good point. I actually have that book coming in through Interlibrary Loan. I'm looking forward to it even more now that you told me about it.
Lots of good stuff there. Beth, your framing of this topic does suggest, I think, immediate relevance in the world that we are currently inhabiting. What should contemporary readers, young and old, draw from Harry Potter's particular brand of good trouble?
Well, I think the most important thing is the idea that if you see something that is wrong, you don't just accept it. You act on it. I think that sometimes it's really, really easy to say, well, this is, you know, this is the way we're supposed to do things, and I don't want to get in trouble. And I think this I love the title that you gave this podcast about good trouble, because I think it really does go back to Dumbledore's very famous statement that it's, you know, sometimes you have to choose between what is right and what is easy. And the easy way is the usual way. It's the way it's always done. It's a way that follows the rules that won't get you into trouble. But sometimes you have to break the rules. Sometimes you have to look at things and you have to say, okay, I realize that this is the rule. I realize it's the way it's always been done, but that's not the best way. That's not the right way. That way is going to hurt people. That way is damaging in, you know, all kinds of ways it could be. It could be, you know, personal. It could be in terms of, you know, the protecting the whole way democracy works, for example. And there are a lot of things that are wrong in wizarding culture. And I think one of the things that readers can take from reading the Harry Potter series critically is to say, you know, this is not an ideal world. It has all kinds of problems. And Harry looks at those problems, and Hermione and Dumbledore and Luna, all of these characters in their different ways look at that world and they rebel. They break the rules. They do things differently. And our world is not identical to the magical world, though it has a lot in common with it. But it's important to stand back and say, hey, wait a minute. Are people being treated right? Is this the best way to do things? And to try to solve those problems. And sometimes you can't solve those problems by following the rules. Sometimes you really have to ask the question, do I have to break these rules? Do I have to get in good trouble in order to make things better? And that's not always the easy way to do it, but I think it's really important. In fact, it's a very difficult way to do it, very difficult. But the books invite readers to ask those hard questions. If you read them in a thoughtful and a critical way.
Mm, score another point for critical thinking.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And look here, we have an arrival through Owl Post.
Look up. It's time for Owl Post.
Hey.
We have a listener question. This question comes from Andy Werman, who is a professor of history at Central Michigan University.
Dear Potterversary, with colleges and universities renaming buildings and taking down statues, what do you think it would take for Hogwarts to change the name of Slytherin House? Yale University recently changed the name of Calhoun College, which was named after the pro-slavery South Carolina politician John Calhoun. Clemson University also removed Calhoun's name from their honors college. John Calhoun was bad, but he didn't build a murder chamber beneath Yale like Salazar Slytherin did at Hogwarts. Calhoun, like Slytherin, was obsessed with pure-blooded and mixed-blooded races. So, what would it take for Hogwarts to change the name of its most infamous house? Thanks.
All right, what do you all think of that question? What would it take? Should they change the name of Slytherin House? Would that be something that the students at Hogwarts should get behind?
There would be a lot of disrupted memes out there, you know. People like to make a lot of jokes about that word Slytherin and, you know, kind of turn it into a verb. And
that's true. You know,
yeah. Maybe some of that would be okay to change that. But yeah. And would, I mean, are we talking about just a name transplant? Or are we talking about like a personality transplant? You know
well,
what I mean?
I right. Mean, well, Slytherin no, I mean, House. I think, yeah. So the idea is that, you know, Slytherin, one of these founders, he obviously did a lot of bad stuff and he held on to ideas that were toxic and corrosive. And does his name need to be off that house?
And he left too, right?
Right. That's
he bailed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And left, you know, the murder chamber and the chamber of secrets down there.
As you do. Behind your murder chamber.
The heir of Slytherin.
I don't think it would be possible. I mean, maybe it would, but think about the enchantments that are keeping the house elves enslaved, keeping them punishing themselves. And imagine, I mean, you've got the sorting hat who is compelled to sort people, even though it thinks that it's not a good idea. I mean, I imagine that there are so many ancient enchantments on Hogwarts, it would be almost impossible to accomplish. And you know, I mean, Emily's point about the memes and the name, the power of language in magic, just that name seems to have in itself a kind of power. I mean, I think there's a really good argument. I love the idea that it ought to be changed. And I could imagine, I suspect there's some things out there named after the Malfoy family because they've been giving money to things all the time. And those names really ought to be changed. But I think would be almost impossible.
Yeah, and I wonder if, like what you're saying with the various enchantments, we can see that as also maybe a metaphor for the way that certain historical figures can be so intertwined with our cultural traditions and so on that they're maybe even a little too hard to erase. I think about Columbus, for example. What would it take? Living in the city named after him, right? Think about what all the things that would have to change and all the people who would have to just be done in order to make that change. And I don't think Wizarding Society is done with Slytherin. And so I think that the roots are pretty deep there and that it would be hard to do.
Yeah. And you know, what makes for good practice in you know, our society doesn't always make for the best story. You know, I mean, so my students are studying, next week we'll be studying Mormonism. And in Mormonism, there's this idea of adversity, this idea of kind of having there being kind of an opposition in all things so that you have a chance to show your more heroic side in standing up against that opposition or resisting that opposition. And so I think Slytherin plays a pretty important role in allowing our heroes in the story to be heroic.
Yeah. So you're saying that, like, functionally in the story, you have to have your Slytherin house.
I mean, there I go, you know, looking at it like literature.
Yeah.
How dare you?
But if it were real, Emily, come on.
He's gone. He's out. All the memes gone.
Well, it should be. But I not only, even leaving aside all of the enchantments that are no doubt on the whole institution and the whole building and, you know, the sorting hat and everything else, I don't see wizard culture accepting it. There is a really conservative, in, you know, small c sense, strain in wizard and magical culture. I mean, yeah, obviously they're still using locomotive and all of this medieval stuff and not taking advantage of all of the modern technology that they really could get some good use from. And changing the name just seems like so much more than you could imagine from them. It's an admirable plan, but boy, they're just not. For all of the things I could imagine Hermione accomplishing to help out the house elves, for example, I mean, and that's going to take centuries to solve. In some ways, the name Slytherin House seems very superficial, but on the other hand, it's, as you say, I mean, how would you change Columbus? I guess in some ways it would be easier in the magical world because you can just change the signs magically.
Yeah,
you know, change the maps magically. But still, it just seems, it seems ingrained in the way, you know, a just deep and fundamental way.
Right, ways we don't even realize, perhaps.
Yeah, it'll take a little more creativity than maybe we think is possible. But it is interesting to think about that, and I think that's a creative question that, you know, it just hadn't occurred to me that you could potentially think about doing something like that. You know, and would that be a kind of political defiance that might be useful? But on the other hand, like, I'm not sure always exactly what it does to change something that would just be like a superficial change. You know, we can take Calhoun's name off the buildings, but if we don't change some of our, you know, unequal, unjust policies, then what have we really done? You know, we have to do more.
Deeply true.
That brings us to the end of our episode today. Thanks so much to Dr. Beth Sutton Ramspeck for being on the show. Thanks, Beth.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun.
This was a great conversation, and I really feel like I got a chance to explore your talk, you know, in this conversational way that I just really appreciated.
Yeah.
Well, it was fun to talk about. It helped me have some ideas too.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That's the best part of school. Mm-hmm. That's Potterversity's purpose here. Great conversations.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to PotterversityPodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
As Harry Potter said, I don't go looking for trouble. Trouble usually finds me. Listeners, if any trouble out there finds you, I hope it's good trouble. Until next time, class dismissed.